The mines of Minnesota's Iron Range exploded in major strikes in the first two decades of the 20th century. Workers wanted better pay, safer working conditions, and most of all, an end to the contract wage system. They wanted the right to unionize, but the Steel Trust, the nickname given Oliver Mining Company by its detractors, quashed even the slightest hint of labor unrest. It was the Trust's inflexible campaign against unions and its relentless push to increase productivity and profits in its northeast Minnesota mines, slave driving its miners to exhaustion, discarding injured and used-up miners, and replacing them with a fresh supply of immigrants that led, in 1907, to the Mesabi Rain Strike, the first large clash between labor and the Steel Trust, whose headquarters located in the east and were overseen by their founder, the Gilded Age industrialist John Pierpont Morgan. What were conditions really like for the iron miner at the turn of last century? What made 1907 the ripe moment to strike? And how did the actions of 15,000 miners, dock workers, and strike leaders, most of them immigrants, many of them Finnish, lay the groundwork for future generations of laboring Minnesotans, when in the short term, their efforts were utterly crushed? These are some of the questions that arise when studying that era of labor history. And this is the story of the Mesabi Rain Strike of 1907.
July 26, 1907. The Western Federation of Miners has struck its first blow in Minnesota, and the steel company is determined to drive it from the state at any cost. They do not believe the Federation exists to benefit the men, but to make trouble, arouse dissatisfaction, and turn all working men into socialists. The parent organization has adopted the socialist propaganda, and it was the Finnish socialists on the range who brought the Federation in and are the backbone of its organization in Minnesota. The Minneapolis Journal.
We had a more than average literate population, partly because of the immigration from Northern Europe, where people at least read in their own language, if not in English, and soon learned to read English.
Historian Rhoda Gilman isn't at all surprised by the Iron Range's history of labor agitation.
Therefore, they were better informed and more inclined to get together and organize.
In 2012, Gilman published Stand Up, a history of Minnesota's protest tradition.
Our demographics in Minnesota, of course, is even more than Wisconsin. It's a varied state in terms geographically and demographically. I mean, we have the Iron Range, and it has a large Finnish population up there again. When I first saw the Iron Range, which was back in the 1960s, it really looked like a moonscape. I mean, the piles of mine waste and the enormous pits were still empty. Now they're mostly filled with lakes and trees have grown up. So it looks a little more like the country originally looked, but it was really a wasteland then.
Wasteland. Not unlike the wastes of no man's land, seen a decade later in the Great War, the instruments of modern warfare denuding forest and meadow and transforming fields into quagmires of mud, barbed wire, and bodies. On the Iron Range, the process of environmental disaster occurred nearly as fast, but the woodlands of birch, popple, and pine were cleared first to fuel an enormous building boom brought on by an industrializing America, and second, to uncover the vast stores of wealth bedded under the thin topsoil. Iron had been discovered in the late 19th century in what is today called the Vermilion Iron Range, and where there were mines, there was an enormous need for miners. Many would step right off the boats at Ellis Island and into the mines. Italians, Norwegians, Swedes, Slavs, and Finns. Some 40 different ethnic groups all told. But it was the Finns who would play a key role in the 1907 strike.
They were the one group, although they had a lot of help from the South Slavs and the Italians and other groups, but it was primarily the Finns who were the leaders of the strikes and of the agitation for economic justice. There's no doubt about that.
Pam Brunfeld is a lifelong Iron Ranger, a range historian, and a Finnish American.
It was one of the reasons why they were often persecuted, both by the companies and by people here in the area. The elites in the area didn't like the Finns much because they weren't compliant and they couldn't control them. Well, one of the interesting aspects of the Iron Range is that it's only a few miles wide, 10 miles wide probably at its greatest width. Eveleth and Chisholm and Buell and Hibbing and Virginia and Gilbert, and that virtually everything within that 10-mile span has been altered by the hand of man. There is very little of the natural landscape left within that 10-mile width. Otherwise, it's been completely changed by the hand of man through the mining operations. In 1884, the first shipment of ore left the Sedan mine, and the first wave of immigrants arrived in what would become the Vermilion Iron Range. The first shipment left the Sedan mine on July 31st, 1884. To give you an idea of how valuable the ore was, the Chandler mine, for the first 19 years of its existence, paid its investors $100,000 a month. So the ore was incredibly valuable. U.S. Steel Corporation was organized in 1901, and it was capitalized for $1.4 billion. And I can guarantee you they did not capitalize that company for that amount of money for the steel plants owned by Andrew Carnegie and his peers. They were investing in the iron ore here. The ore on the Mesabi was found in 1890. And the first shipment of ore left the Mesabi Iron Range on October 12, 1892. I've begun to say that it's one of the most important dates in American history, and it rivals in its importance the July 4, 1776 date. The ore from the Mesabi Iron Range was so valuable that the industrialization of the United States literally occurred because of it. Up until the time of the discovery of the Mesabi Iron Range, this country could not produce the amount of iron and, by consequence, then steel that it would have needed to industrialize this country. The New York skyline, the Chicago skyline, the San Francisco skyline, any of the big cities in this country would not look like they do today without Mesabi iron ore. I argue that we would neither have become a world power nor the industrial economic giant that we became without the iron ore that's in the ground here. And it was the people of the Iron Range who made that possible.
If you could go back in time to the Mesabi in the early part of the 20th century, you'd find a northern Minnesota version of the Old West. But instead of cowboys, you had miners speaking a babble of languages, young, robust men, largely from old world peasant stock, stepping dusty and begrimed from mines to blow a week's pay in saloons and on prostitutes. Those not inclined to booze away their earnings joined temperance halls. Imagine a world where there was a vast preponderance of men to women. The few women there were ran boarding houses, they cooked and they cleaned, and they fended off proposals from men far from home and lonely. Itinerant villages called locations grew up alongside the pits. Rude shacks squatted along rutted paths. Milk cows and chickens crowded into small pens. The regular detonation of dynamite blasted into the afternoon heat and shook the windows. Trains picked up loads of ore and rattled them east to ports in Duluth and Superior. Huge mountains of waste rock rose next to the pits and blotted out the sky. It was a vigorous, dirty, noisy, and exciting time to be a miner on the range. But for all that, the work was hard and underpaid, often on a speed-up when it wasn't shut down during lulls or during the winter months. And it was dangerous work. when you heard a siren blare. You prayed it wasn't your husband or father or brother. They'd be pulling lifeless out of the mine that night.
Part of the big picture is work in the United States was changing in the late 19th and early 20th century, changing from being primarily skilled work done by artisans in relatively individual settings to becoming increasingly unskilled and mechanized work.
As a professor at McAllister College in St. Paul, Peter Ratcliffe specializes in labor and immigrant history.
The workforce was changing. After 1880 or so, large numbers of immigrants were coming to the United States, mostly from Southern and Eastern Europe, but also from Finland, coming to take these unskilled jobs, which were often dangerous, mining jobs, meatpacking jobs, steel mill jobs. They were dangerous. They were low paid. They were often thought of as a different race. They were not seen as white. The gradations between white and black were a lot more complicated than they are now. So the work was changing. The workforce was changing. Corporate structures were also changing. So it's the era of the so-called robber barons and all of those terms that we remember from high school social studies of trusts and pools and monopolies and holding companies. And it's something that Upton Sinclair tried to capture with his novel Oil, which became the recent film There Will Be Blood, this rise of kind of corporate doggy-dogism. And so all of that is creating a very turbulent, conflictual environment in the late 19th and early 20th century. It's leading to economic development in some areas that the Finnish activist and historian Karl Ross would later coin the term the industrial frontier. Karl described the industrial frontier as spanning from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where he was born, in the copper mining region, across the Iron Range of Minnesota, across North Dakota, the Badlands, and then into Montana, and again, copper country around Butte. And this industrial frontier, the way we think of the frontier in American mythology, of a kind of lawlessness, of very harsh living conditions, this very rough kind of lifestyle. That's what Minnesota's Iron Range was like in the period from when it opened in the early 1890s, well into the really into the Great Depression, when workers finally succeeded in unionizing and in really gaining political as well as economic citizenship. Because the majority of these communities across what Karl called the industrial frontier were unincorporated communities. People didn't have the right to vote. They were kind of like internal colonies. And immigrants came and were plunked down there and put to work, and many of them died, and many of them were injured and got no kind of benefits or security. It was a very, very harsh lifestyle.
You've got to join that one big union. You've got to join it by yourself. Everybody here will join it with you. You've got to join the one big union by yourself. If that road gets rough and rocky.
In the case of the mines, a very big issue was the way the workers were paid. And they were paid on what was called the contract system. And that is, they were paid by the amount of iron that each worker could pick and shovel out of the mine in the course of a day.
They never knew what their pay was going to be from month to month.
Pam Brunfelt.
They had to pay for their candles. They had to pay for their blasting caps. They had to pay for their dynamite. They had to pay for broken tools. They had to pay for the drill bits. They didn't get paid unless they were mining. If they were putting up supports in the underground mines to keep them safe, they weren't paid while they were building the roof supports. They weren't paid if they had to lay track. They weren't paid during that time. They were only paid when they were mining ore. It was literally sweatshop labor. and often on a speed-up. If they were known to be activists, labor activists, they were given bad places in the mine where there was low ore or there was hard rock. The captains in the mine were often hated because they would engage in forms of extortion. If the miners wanted a good place in the mine, they sometimes had to pay a bribe or a kickback. I think one of the most interesting aspects of the Iron Range is that 43 different ethnic groups came here, couldn't speak to each other. The mining companies threw them together onto contract gangs where they had to learn how to trust each other and had to learn how to communicate with each other in spite of language barriers.
July 26, 1907. Here at Virginia, light was thrown on the origin of the strike. The union made its demand on July 18 with notice of strike on July 29 if it was not granted. The next day, 220 men were laid off at the Mountain Iron Mine. Petriella says they were all union men and were fired for that reason. M.S. Hawkins, superintendent of the Mountain Iron, was in Virginia. He told the governor and the newspaper men that 196 men were laid off on that day solely because of the dock strike. There were only 84 Finns in the number. The Minneapolis Journal.
You could say the Mesabi rain strike of 1907 was an accident. It all began when a bunch of dock workers in Duluth walked off the job. The dock workers shipped the ore mined on the range. With boats stalled in the harbor, Oliver Mine Company slowed production in its mines. That meant layoffs. And when the Western Federation of Miners, represented by Teofilo Petriella and a number of Finnish miners, piggybacked on the dock workers' strike, threatening to walk off if demands weren't met, Oliver laid off nearly 200 men from its Mountain Iron Mine. Men singled out because they were suspected union members. The Finns had invited the Western Federation of Miners to the range only 2 years before. Unionizing the range had been slow. Many miners feared repression from the Steel Trust. Petriella was brought in to help. An Italian immigrant, he understood ethnic cohesiveness and recruited organizers from each ethnicity to talk to their members. The Federation had seen membership numbers swell, but they were far from ready to tackle the trust. The dock workers' strike forced their hand. The Finnish immigrants, who composed the largest segment of Iron Rangers, joined the picket and walked mine to mine across the range, and joining others to strike.
Duluth, Minnesota, July 22, 1907. Practically all of the Steel Corporation mines in northern Minnesota are closed down today as a result of either the strike of the dock workers or the mine workers on the range. It is impossible to estimate the number of men idle as a result of the two strikes, but it is in excess of 15,000. The Western Federation of Miners is attempting to force a scale of wages on the company, calling for $2.50 a day for surface work and $3 for underground work for a day of 8 hours. Hibbing is said to be bristling with rifles in expectation of trouble. The red flag was carried in a parade in Sparta on Sunday by Finnish socialists. Red neckties are the mark of the socialists. The extreme quietness is a new sensation for Eveleth and impresses everyone. The Minneapolis Journal.
So here's this environment on the range. Here are these immigrants with virtually no rights.
Peter Ratcliffe.
Sheriff is controlled by the mines, and it is a kind of colonialism because the mines are controlled in Pittsburgh or even New York. So the financial end of the industry and the organizational end of the industry and the power is thousands of miles away. And so from that position, the miners are trying to organize and facing ferocious, not only physical repression, but also a great deal of racism and cultural disregard. So the Duluth newspapers in that period would refer to the Finnish miners as jackpine savages, suggesting that they were no more civilized than Native Americans and Of course, we have a much more complex understanding about Native Americans today than the media had and the white elite had at that time.
July 24, 1907. George W. Perkins, chairman of the Finance Committee of the United States Steel Corporation, was asked today whether the corporation was likely to make any concessions to the striking miners in Minnesota. "It is not a question of concessions now," he said. "These men have struck in violation of their agreement and without giving us proper notice of their intentions, not even a reasonable time to consider the matter contained in their letter of demands." The Minneapolis Journal.
The miners didn't have a chance. The powerful steel trust wouldn't even agree to meet with their leaders. They didn't have to. In town after town across the range, merchants refused to do business with the miners. They wouldn't sell them food. They argued with them. "You've got jobs. You have roofs over your heads. Don't you know there wouldn't be a range without the steel trust?" The Steel Trust paid out $255,000, an incredible sum of money at that time, to break the strike. They hired a private corps of deputies. They armed them with rifles. They shipped Pinkerton detectives from the east. And train after train arrived on the Iron Range, unloading what would be the Trojan horse of the 1907 strike. Immigrants just off the boat, and hungry for the American dream.
Hibbing, Minnesota, August 3, 1907. The strike is broken. The mines are shipping. The Steel Corporation has 7 steam shovels loading ore today and will be shipping up to the regular schedule by Wednesday. The strikers still hold an organization but have lost 30%. They say they will keep up the strike indefinitely. But if they obey the governor's proclamation, they will not seriously interfere, as the mining of iron requires but little skill, and new men are plentiful. The Minneapolis Journal.
Peter Ratcliffe.
And in many cases, these miners were blacklisted. They were fired and blacklisted for participating in the strike in 1907. Given the nature of the global economy, because there was a global economy 100 years ago, just like there's one today, it's not a new invention today, that political and economic change was happening in other parts of the world in the early 20th century. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was in the throes of internal revolt and ethnic hostilities and challenges to the Archduke. And as a result, companies like Oliver Mining and the United States Steel Company were able to recruit workers from Croatia, from Serbia, from all these places to come and take the jobs that the Finns had been holding and now had gone on strike.
And what came out of it was a sense of solidarity and a sense of the common good.
Pam Bruenfeld.
As time passed, these organizations would change with the times. But it was always based on the idea that we have to look out for each other. We have to look out for each other. We have to look out for each other. We got to take care of each other. We have to be together. But a lot of them also discovered a freedom here that they would never have had there. I think one of the reasons the Finns became such leaders in the industrial labor movements was they were more literate than almost any other immigrant group. The Finnish National Church required that they be literate before they could be married or confirmed. And so 94% of all Finnish immigrants came over here literate, which meant they were less compliant because they could read and they had their own newspapers and they were quite willing to express their opinions. One of the other things that Finns in particular discovered is that they had the right to think for themselves for the first time. And they had a freedom to disagree, and they had the freedom to think for themselves. And I think that was true of a lot of immigrants who came here.
In her book, Stand Up, Rhoda Gilman documents the maturation of the Iron Range labor movement from the failed 1907 strike to its successor, the strike of 1916.
The Western Federation of Miners no longer existed by 1916. One of the reasons for that strike was the war was going on in Europe. We weren't yet a part of it. But the mines were making, the United States Steel Company was making out like a bandit, but wages had not risen. The guys that had come in from the Balkans, at first they spoke different languages, they were from different countries. Quite a few, I guess, were Russian Orthodox. Others were Roman Catholics. It took them a while to get acquainted, to all learn to speak English, and to learn what unions were all about. But by 1916, they'd learned. I mean, it didn't take them that long. The strike started sort of spontaneously. It wasn't planned. A guy threw down his hammer, whatever he was using, and said, "I'm quitting, you're going to join me." And within days, there were parades of miners all along the Mesabi. It had spread that fast. So there was a lot of discontent.
You know, as I try as a historian to understand, I'm not somebody who grew up in Minnesota, but I've lived here 30 years now. You know, what's particular to Minnesota? And it isn't some abstract thing like, oh, they're from Scandinavia. It's these sets of experiences that people had here, beginning with some of the values and ideas that they brought with them from the old country, whatever it was. But the ways that those things got mixed together as ingredients in a recipe and created a kind of multiculturalism on the range and here in the Twin Cities and in southern Minnesota that then found in the labor movement and found for a time in the DFL a way to express itself. And I think part of the challenge of the 21st century is to find the vehicle. And all I can say as a historian is that I'm sure something interesting will come out of it.
This is Britt Amit for KFAI.
I see there a low
voice narration provided by Michael Fishbein.
I see there letting
Mini Culture on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
And the new dirt's a-fallin'.